This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to Arguing History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor Emeritus at the Exeter University. He is without a doubt the most prolific historian writing in the Anglophone world today. And today we are discussing the topic, history. What is it good for and why? Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor, what does history mean to you as a practicing historian?
History to me means the past. It means how we tell stories about and interrogate the past. And it means the trust between the generations, the sense of an awareness that we are part of a process of continuity and change through time.
Publishers in the world outside of academia influence the practice of history?
Oh, well, I think that's a really excellent question. I think, first of all, it varies enormously by country, so that in an authoritarian society where the government, as it were, allows only a range of history to be on offer, then clearly publishers have to conform to that, and indeed publishers may well be a branch of the state. But if what we are talking about is the alternative to authoritarianism, which is liberal free market capitalism, then clearly publishers have a much greater range within which to operate. They are essentially drawn by their view, their perception of what is likely to be commercially attractive, and therefore, in a way, history in a capitalist society is a counterpart to democracy, because just as democratic politics is designed to try and offer the public a view which matches in part what you think they are going to elect or might elect, so the same thing is true of publication. You're trying to write something which you hope is going to be commercially viable.
How did Leopold von Ranke change how historians did history, if at all, in your opinion?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, just for the benefit of listeners, Ranke was Prussian. Prussia is the country that becomes the genesis of modern Germany, capital Berlin. Ranke was the most prominent historian at the university in Berlin, and he essentially developed a tradition in German historical scholarship of source-based criticism, in other words, of criticizing theses and ideas based upon an analysis in detail of particular texts, the criticism or exegesis of those texts, and using those with which to examine, as it were, grander ideas. And that was, in his eyes, a contrast with more romantic conceptions of history as a process that, as it were, floated above any such vulgar need to address real issues and what people had really said. So Ranke can be seen, this is quite simplified, but Ranke can be seen as a materialist response to the idealistic romantic philosophy of German thought in the late 18th and even more early 19th century. Paradoxically, in a sense, Ranke, although very different in his politics and in the patronage he receives, Ranke offers a sort of counterpart to Karl Marx, another distinguished German who was around at the same time. Now, I think it's fair to say there had been earlier practices of history which also looked carefully at historical documents. One can think in particular of the antiquarian and local history traditions. One can think of a lot of ecclesiastical history. One can think of the exegesis of classical documents that you see, for example, with some of the leading Renaissance commentators. But nevertheless, in terms of academic scholarship, I think it's fair to say that, I mean, you take, so shall we say, England, there had been two universities prior to the 19th century, Oxford and Cambridge. They both have chairs in modern history from 1724. And neither of them, I think it's fair to say, were particularly distinguished or necessarily always noted for their focus on source-based history. And I think with the German model in the late 19th century, the spread of the German model, I mean, Ranke's really a mid-19th century writer, but the spread of the German model helps to produce what is referred to as scientific history. So in America, it comes in particular through its influence in the University of Chicago. In Britain, I think it's fair to say that amateurism remains very strong in Oxford and Cambridge, but a kind of scientific history comes in much more clearly at London, at the Universities of London and of Manchester.
So you would say that, in essence, Ranke is very much a different type of historian than, say, Macaulay or Gibbon.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And Macaulay and Gibbon are different to each other. I mean, Gibbon is in an 18th century tradition of presenting universal or world history, as you will know. His book is widely held to be on the decline of the Roman Empire. It, in fact, is a history of the world up to the 16th century. And much of its interest is actually relates to his treatment of the medieval period. And Gibbon is one of a number of prominent 18th centurists. Another one is French scholar Voltaire, for example, who are trying to write universal history that is not around a Christian chronology or paradigm. Macaulay is from a rather different tradition to that. But yes, you are correct in saying that although both Gibbon and Macaulay are aware of the importance of individual documents, neither of them are scholars who devoted their time to extensive archival work. I think that's a fairly safe remark to make. And I have the greatest of admiration for Gibbon, I ought to tell you.
Understood. How, if at all, has history as a discipline changed in the past 100 years?
Well, that my starter for three, as it were. Let's let's go for several different ways of looking at it. First of all, I think we would allow for variety around the world. We'd allow for variety by political system. I think what one would, if one was looking at it as a educational matter, history is in relative terms become less consequential because of the relative rise at school and university level and college level of any type of the sciences and also of what are termed the social sciences. So that whereas history in the late 19th, beginning of the 20th century would have been regarded as one of the principal academic subjects, its ability to present itself, or the ability of its academics to present themselves as people who are offering something that is a form of knowledge that is useful and can be applied, while historians tend to think they've done that, most of the rest of the world hasn't noticed, as it were, their rather sometimes self-serving declarations. Now, so history as a part of education as a whole has become less consequential. History as a aspect of general literature remains very important. I mean, particularly, though not only for male readers over the age of 40, history and biography are two of the principal types of books that are categories of books that are purchased by them. And history has a very strong following on television, and as you know, the very fact that we on the New Book Network look extensively at history reflects a strong interest on the part of listeners. So there is a public world of history, generally very poorly served by university academics, many of whom sort of go on very narrow and often very ideological trips. Then if we look at other aspects of history in the public world, there's an enormous interest at the moment in genealogy, which is one that, again, has been very much helped by television coverage, very much helped by internet usage. And there is, paradoxically, one might say, in societies which predicated to thinking about the future in terms of technological change and in terms of economic transformation, nevertheless are still very much reverential to aspects of the past and referential to the past even more so.
So you wouldn't say that history reaches a peak of its influence around the turn of the beginning of the 20th century.
You mean about 120 years ago?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, I think that would be fair. I mean, as I said, I think since then, 120 years ago, I think history was regarded as very central to education. A lot of prominent, they were mostly men, a lot of prominent men of affairs, as it were, politicians and such like, had studied history or were aware of it. I think that is less the case today because, as I've said, history is now much more of a discretionary element in education systems.
Actually, I was thinking more of the fact that history as a discipline, whether professionally or by amateurs, was important because of the nationalist project, which becomes almost worldwide by the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, that's interesting. Yes, I mean, I think certainly in political terms, history was very, very significant then. And I think blood and soil nationalism is very much historicist. And I would agree with you. I mean, I ought to say there is, though, blood and soil nationalism at the present day. I mean, if you think about, for example, you know, Scottish separatism or Catalan separatism, they're often based about or draw heavily on a narrative of supposed hardship that has occurred in the past, rather than simply focusing on the situation at the present day.
Yes, I definitely would agree with you. And of course, the other example would be, or examples, are authoritarian states where history as a discipline is employed as a means of propagandizing the population.
Yes, I mean, for example, a good instance at the present moment is Turkey, where under Erdogan there is a very strong neo-Ottoman presentation of Turkey as having a destiny to be a leading, if not the leading, figure in the Islamic world. And there have been television series about, Suleiman the Magnificent, I remember when I last visited Turkey, observing a very large public mural which depicted in stone the areas that had been under the Ottoman Empire at its most, at its widest, plus a bit. So you see that. You can see another instance of a very strong historicized nationalism in a different context. You could argue is being taken in modern China, where in place of, for example, an ideology that you might call radical left, you have an ideology of a kind of modern imperium, a kind of progressive China, but with its territorial aspirations very much encoded in what are presented as established, historicized Chinese territorial dominance over Taiwan, over the South China Sea, and a historicized antipathy to Japan, and to the idea that when China was weak, Western powers, America and Japan, all benefited from that in order to exploit the situation. So I would say that the ideology of the Chinese state is very much that way. If you look at India, India has a democracy, but the Modi government is very much pushing a Hindu historicized nationalism in which the idea is that there is a traditional, long-established process in which India was invaded from outside by Islamic forces, and that India has only been strong when, as with the Maharathas, so they are presented in the late 17th century, or Mr. Modi today, there have been Hindu nationalists who have sought to, as it were, to use that kind of classic or cliched image, stem the tide. So these kind of historicized nationalisms are very, very common and play, I would say, quite a significant role in at least the public presentation of politics. President Putin in Crimea is another instance of this.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
When you were starting out, which historian, if any, most engaged or influenced you?
When I was starting out, at what age? I was an odd and rather inconvenient child. I mean, when I was about 6 and 7, I was going to the local public library and taking out history books.
I would actually say when you were in university.
Ah, when I was in university. Right. When I was at university, I was an undergraduate at Cambridge and a postgraduate at Oxford. And I was, as an undergraduate, I was fortunate to go to one of the only two colleges which had a director of studies, chief historian, who was a medievalist. And I did a lot of stuff on medieval history, and I was very taken by the close packed textualism of looking at documents. And I was very fortunate. My director of studies, Jonathan Riley Smith, who was a Crusader historian, fixed up that when I did my Norman England further subject in my last year, he arranged for a woman called Marjorie Chibnall, who was an elderly scholar who was most famous for editing Orderic Vitalis, the great chronicler, to sort of just to teach me. So I would go along and spend 2.5 hours once a week of an afternoon, plus an extra half an hour for tea. And we would talk about the Anglo-Normans as if they were her personal friends. And she would provide me with printed proofs of forthcoming volumes that she was editing. And I also, in my last year, spent a lot of time in the university library reading doctoral theses, which I found a wonderful corrective to the often very mediocre standard of the lectures offered to undergraduates. You know, you had a sense that when you were reading doctorates, or when I was with Marjorie Chibnall and looking at printed primaries, you had a sense that you were, as it were, closer to the cutting edge than what was on offer. And I'm often struck. I mean, I've recently been reading, because I have to write a review of it, some particularly mediocre books about the history of the British Empire, where none of the authors seem to have spent even an afternoon in an archive. And to me, archival history is an absolutely key element, because you need inspiration to encourage it, because it's hard work. People need to be told. You go in, you can spend a day's reading there, and you might have a better general idea of a particular subject, person, individual, or instance, but you might not. You know, the archival sources can be elusive, difficult, etc., etc., or can require a lot of elucidation. But I was very fortunate in that respect. But if you're asking me great historians, well, you know, there were some prominent historians when I was an undergraduate. Probably the most prominent in Cambridge was Sir Geoffrey Elton. And there were some prominent historians when I was at Oxford. I suppose Keith Thomas and Trevor Roper would be the most prominent. But I have to say, I actually found much more satisfactory to be looking at archival sources, reading printed primaries at the time, rather than listening to banal remarks from, they might opine on.
Understood. What does history as an intellectual discipline have to say to us today?
Well, I mean, I think different historians would give you different answers. And also, may I say that people who are not academic historians are just as well qualified to, if they, you know, if they've thought about it, to offer their views. So, and also just one last thing. When I referred to Trevor Roper, Elton and Thomas, of course, I ought to distinguish. Elton was a distinguished archival historian. It's just that many of his lectures didn't necessarily show that. The other two were not. So let me just make that clear. I'm not trying to run down Elton's reputation. If you are looking at it the present day, I mean, I will obviously give you my viewpoint. I mean, my viewpoint is that history is a marvelous tool for understanding complexity, for understanding what I would call a three-dimensionality I suppose if you want to add time as the fourth dimension, but the idea being that there are different interpretations that are possible, that you cannot repeat the experiment, so that you cannot be definitive, that you have to understand nuance, that you have to understand the contrast between people, what people say and maybe what they think, and neither of those are necessarily clear-cut abstractions. Those, to my mind, are all very important aspects of history. But I would argue, unfortunately, that there is very much poor history, and I would include that being done from within the academy as well as outside the academy, and that this is often what I would refer to as two-dimensional. People will often have, as it were, envisaged an outcome in advance, and if they're academics, that generally is the outcome that they think is going to attract the grant-aiding bodies that will fund their research or that might help them get promoted. And they will often sort of, as it were, select evidence accordingly, or indeed not trouble with evidence and just simply argue by assertion. And I think that you and I know that there are many academics we can refer to today, some of them holding positions of some considerable power and influence, who essentially, one would argue by assertion. I remember absolutely being very struck in the early 1990s, a major Cambridge figure of the previous generation. He told me that he'd looked at one of my books and couldn't understand why I had spent so much time in the archives over it. He said to me, "I had last set foot in an archive 10 years ago, and I never intend to go in one again." And actually, the man's gone on writing, and, you know, I can see that seems to be very much the case. And, you know, to me, some people would argue that that is the way forward, that having, you know, you don't want to be held back by the limitations, because there are limitations of primary sources, because after all, not everything is covered by them. And there are issues of intentionality in terms of why people say something. They're not a palimpsest, a mirror of reality. But nevertheless, I think the very fact that they are complex helps to avoid one making grand statements about the nature of the historical pattern.
Are you worried that today's cultural warriors, whose mendacity is only succeeded by their ignorance, will ruin history?
Well, I think certainly I am not in favor of what you are talking about. So I agree with you entirely. There are several different levels of would it ruin history. Will it affect the nature of history as an educational tool? Well, it already has done. I myself would be very wary about suggesting to anybody that they go and do a history degree at any institution which says that it is decolonizing its syllabus, because the nature of the past is too complex to reduce to a formulation of the present. So I think that's already happened. Do I have more confidence in the public as a whole? Well, yes, I do, actually. I think that there is a lot of reluctance to be pushed towards the false consciousness which is offered by these so-called intellectuals. So yes, I would be, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm a Democrat. I believe that means that people often can choose to do things you don't want them to do. But nevertheless, part of democracy is that you accept other people will make poor choices. What I find disappointing is when you have people who are anti-democratic, who take over institutions and then seek to use either those institutions or the practice of politics to limit the opportunities and options for the members of the public as a whole. And I think that is going on. I mean, positive aspects is, for example, it is possible, thanks to new technology, for people like ourselves to discuss something, for that then to be offered through the internet and other means to a large number of people who can then listen, so that in a way, whatever is the folly at particular educational institutions, it doesn't need to constrain us excessively. But yes, do I worry? Yes, I think I do worry. I think it's become bizarre. I mean, you know, at the present moment, if you look around the world, and, you know, different listeners will have differing points of view here, but at the very crudest political level, you can see that places like Myanmar or Belarus, there are active suppression of democratic tendencies at the present day, same in Russia, for example. And yet, There are people who would be much happier to ignore that, or for that matter, to ignore the plight of many Africans in wars at the present moment. For example, the current civil war in Ethiopia, which Eritrea has come in on, and they'd rather be offering tendentious remarks about the past, which, as it were, empowers them in a sort of politicized present. So, yes, I am. I am concerned about it. I can only hope that its political traction with the public as a whole will be limited.
Any last thoughts, Professor Black?
Well, I think that some of the points we made at the very outset could do with a little bit more of deploying. I mean, I think this contrast between public and private history is one that is worth thinking about. All listeners will have what I would call a private history to themselves and their family, but also a broader community private history, notions about their relationship with the previous generation being absolutely fundamental to that. Then separate to that, I think there are the different kinds of groups that offer and sometimes seek to control what I would call public history. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because it's important when we're trying to locate ourselves that there are opportunities given to people, to individuals, to communities, to consider, as it were, their relationship with their past. The problem is when you try and close down those options and limit them. So, for example, if you're thinking about Germany in the 1930s, if you're at the beginning of the 1930s, there are a number of different historical narratives on offer. There are politicized ones from the extreme left to the extreme right and all stages in between. There are institutional ones of a varied sort of institutional fabric of Germany of that period. There are regional ones, ones of localities, and some of those are politically encoded, and some of them are just expressions of regional difference. And then there are the vast range of private and community ones. Now, one of the aspects of the Nazi seizure of power in 1933, and it's the same with other authoritarian seizures of power, the communists in the Soviet Union, for example, what becomes the Soviet Union, is that this range is closed down dramatically. Occasionally, attempts are made to co-opt aspects of a broader pattern. So, for example, you know, you're in Germany, the Wehrmacht has its historical tradition, the Catholic Church has its historical tradition, you try and Nazify them. But more commonly, you just try and get rid of the groups or exponents of those who have a different history to the one you offer. And in that context, you end up with a desperately impoverished politics. I mean, you know, there's a whole host of things that you can say about the viciousness and megalomania, destructiveness about the Third Reich. One of the things that's most, I think, worth commenting on is also its absolutely profound intellectual poverty and cultural poverty. I don't mean by that that there were not some cultural figures or artistic figures within it, but what I mean was that the idea of variety, the idea of debate as means to advance a subject, to offer individual or different interpretations, that was lost. The notion almost of, if you like, a Hegelian notion of let us entertain both a synthesis and a thesis and an antithesis, and then we'll see what happens about binging and bonging between them. This is lost. And I think you could see that as a way in which historical consciousness exists in modernity. You have, on the one hand, those societies where there is a willingness to accept a public and a private space for these very differing interpretations, which may be to some people, even to the public mythos of that society, dominant one,
inconvenient, damaging. But to understand that part of being a mature society, part of being a democratic culture, is that you have those viewpoints. And on contrast, there is the authoritarian precept and practice of arguing that there is a correct answer and that other viewpoints should be closed down. Now, the closing down can take different forms. It can be the literal question of throwing people out of windows or, you know, putting them into detention camps and murdering them. Or it could be the starting off things like just, you know, not promoting them, not appointing people of that type, not giving them grants, etc., etc. Now, what I would argue is happening, and I do not regard this as overly alarmist, I actually have, you know, can see it going on, is that the broader pattern of what I would regard as a fair-minded debate is one that is closed down in large sections of what would consider itself the progressive West. Because once you have a notion that there is a correct answer, you know, and obviously at the present moment, a lot of that is to do with agendas, to do with so-called diversity and whatever. A lot of it is to do with a kind of critique of the West. A lot of it is now moved from just critiquing the West, capitalism, etc., to actually attacking what are termed Enlightenment values, or Enlightenment values, as you and I know. Enlightenment had lots of contradictions, but one of the points of the Enlightenment was that one of the key values was that of debate. Once you start, and fact-based understanding, once you start moving beyond that, then in practical terms, you're taking part in a different form of authoritarianism to that that is practiced in the more ruthless states that we could mention. And in my mind, it is highly troubling. Now, I don't think we are seeing the end of history as we know it, as a matter conceived of in the West in terms of debates. When I was a child, you could listen to sort of Sussex tapes and hear historians with different points of view debating matters in a way that now I think would be far less common or accepted, because of course those views, some of them would be regarded as unacceptable. So I'm not saying so much we're seeing an end of it in that type, because what I do notice is that beyond the academy, there is an active public world which is less impressed by the often narrow and illiberal notions of so much academic culture. But nevertheless, it is a troubling matter, and I'm not really impressed by what is going on, and it has been gathering pace farther and faster than I had envisaged. So, you know, I used to think it would see me out, the idea of history as a subject of debate in which you could hold unpopular views, in which you could still be respected for the scholarship that you brought to them and for the cogency of your academic argument, sorry, your intellectual argument. I'm no longer convinced that is the case. And I'm not saying this in tone of a grumbly old man. I actually am still somebody who I'd like to think is of great vitality and working actively in the subject, but I am not so impressed by the context of the academic world as a means of taking forward our understanding and elucidation of the past.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. Thanks for listening to Arguing History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black.
Thank you.